Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thanks for tuning in today. I appreciate it. We've got plenty to talk about. It's been a couple weeks since we've done a show. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving, even though that's a couple weeks behind us. Hope your holiday preparations, if you are making any, are going well. You can get a hold of me via Twitter, X Threads, Instagram, and Blue Sky at Ryan Ballingy. Email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. I have a couple topics and an interview for you today. It'll be fun. It'll be a good show. And we'll probably have one more, maybe two more shows to end the year. I always have a hard time trying to find an endpoint for this show when I've done it like weekly. And the struggle is, well, there's always something to talk about. It's just, does anybody care? And at this time of year, especially with what we're going to talk about today, and just kind of it feels like an existential moment in golf. Not like golf's going away, just an existential moment. And multiple fronts of that existential moment are happening. It's like the teen years, like everything's drama. There's nothing that's simple. And that's kind of annoying on one hand, but also important to talk about, I think, on the other, especially for a show that, you know, I'm a total golf sicko and geek who talks about this kind of stuff. So did want to do a show this week. We probably will have enough material for a show next week, and then I think we're just going to shut it down for the year. So today I want to talk about a couple of different things. We're going to start with the rollback, and then we're going to talk about LIV and the PGA Tour and Jon Rahm and all that stuff that's going on there. That'll kind of be one segment unto itself. So I want to start with the rollback. I've done a fair amount of content about this already because I've been talking about this thing for like 20 years. Almost 20 years where I've been talking about the need for a rollback in golf ball equipment or golf equipment standards. I have harped on the ball forever, but just equipment rollback. The ball shouldn't go as far or you shouldn't hit it as far. And I've long made that argument. And it sounds like I'm going to get my wish. However many years I have ended up having this conversation. Mike Stachura from Golf Digest, great equipment writer. Also a great human being, just a great guy. He put out a piece on Friday that you should read, and that Friday piece was sourced from a couple of different industry sources that said this week, because we're now into this week, the USGA and the RNA are going to announce a rollback of golf ball standards, and that is not going to be in the form of a model local rule like they discussed in April. Instead, it's going to be a universal rule that will apply to everybody. So that model local rule, the idea that they threw out there earlier in the year around April, where they said, we propose this rule. We want to have an equipment standard effectively that applies to professional tours and high-level amateurs, and they should adopt it. And then everybody else can have the existing equipment standard. So if you don't play competitive golf, if you know, you're not playing USGA sanctioned events or RNA sanctioned events or competitions, then, or under those rules, then this doesn't apply to you. You can just keep playing whatever equipment you want. You can play conforming equipment, non-conforming equipment. That was the idea. Bifurcation, which is what I've kind of been arguing for 20 years. There should be two sets of rules because professional golf and amateur golf or recreational golf are not really the same. They're not played the same way. The equipment that professionals have access to, ultimately all of us could access, but we don't have, most of us, do not have the means, knowledge, skill, or wherewithal to acquire it. And some of it you just can't. I mean, there are some versions of like Titleist golf balls or other golf balls that are just made for tour players and very small batches, and they don't sell to the public, and you couldn't get a hold of even if you had the best eBay account. So my argument has been, well, if we really aren't playing the same game, why do we have the same equipment standard? It doesn't really matter. And the reaction to that model local rule from two very key constituents was apoplectic. First, from professional golfers, who were like, well, this is going to ruin the game. Why are you punishing us? Why does this have to happen? This shouldn't have to happen. We're not going to do that. We're going to have our own equipment standard. And the PGA Tour basically came out and said, we don't support this. And basically threatened that if this model local rule were to be implemented, they might not adopt it. They might just decide to do their own equipment standard, which is a whole ball of wax unto itself, because then you'd have to create your own testing standards. And oh my gosh, that's not something that PGA Tour players wanted. I promise that. But the PGA of America also came out and said, look, you know, we're not so sure about this either, because we represent professional golfers, and we believe that's not in the best interest of the recreational golfers that our 29,000 members help, service, whatever. Then you had different reaction from other parts of the golf world. Bridgestone Golf is one of the few folks that put out a statement. TaylorMade did too. TaylorMade's not in favor of it. Bridgestone's like, well, you know, we'll assess it. And they never really added on top of it. They were just kind of agnostic about it. Like, we make great golf balls, we'll make great golf balls, whatever the rules are. Who cares? And then Augusta National more or less said, like, you know, if you give us the chance to make a tournament ball, we'll do it. And they've kind of hinted at that in the past. So based on the reaction from them and those groups, professionals and manufacturers, it sounds like, based on Stachura's reporting, that what's coming down the pipe isn't then the model local rule. It's universal. The USGA and the RNA have kind of telegraphed this, particularly the RNA's Martin Slumbers. He also talked to a guy from Digest, John Huggin, who's overseas. And John's a great writer and interesting guy. And Huggin got a great interview with Slumbers. And Slumbers says, look, we propose this model local rule. We have a couple of choices. We can do nothing, and we're not doing nothing. We could do the model local rule, but everyone complained about that. Or, kind of insinuating, if those aren't the choices, then we do it for everybody. And so that's what it sounds like it's going to be. So what are the details of this change? It's basically a really simple way to roll back golf ball. The USGA and the RNA have equipment standards. They have equipment testing facilities. They test equipment to make sure it complies with the rules of golf that they've set and they agree upon. And for golf balls, they test whether a golf ball is conforming to determine how far it flies. You have to find out whether it flies 317 yards. And you get 3 yards of tolerance. So really, you could fly 320 yards and be conforming. Which, when you think about that, that's like a 1% deviation, which that's pretty impressive as an engineering feat, by the way. And the whole thing, and a quick aside, I mean, I've done a number of equipment pieces, stories, tours, those things over the years. I have pro rollback, but what the equipment companies accomplish is really incredible and very impressive. And none of what my pro rollback stance is to take away from what they do and accomplish. It really is impressive. That all said, they test that standard using a robot, hitting a driver at a swing speed of 120 miles per hour. Iron by iron, one after another, and they test them. Well, what they would do on the rollback is they would keep the same distance standard, like 317 yards plus 3 yards. But they would test using a robot swinging at 125 miles per hour. So every additional mile per hour of swing usually leads to about 3 yards. Well, if you do 5 extra miles per hour, that's about 15 yards. So 15 yards off 317, right about, not exactly, 5%. 1 yard short of 5%, but effectively 5%. Because different conditions, different shafts, all kinds of different things. Just call it 5% for the sake of argument. And that's how they would roll it back. And this would apply to everybody. So if you drive the ball 300 yards, then the ball goes 15 yards less, 285. You drive the ball 200 yards, it goes 10 yards less, 190. You drive the ball 250, it goes 12.5 less, 237.5. And the reaction depends on where you are in the industry, what kind of person you are. It's varied. And I found that interesting. So I predominantly spend any social media time that I have on Twitter, or it's known as X these days. And that's where I've built a following. So that's where I'm comfortable, right? The reaction to that in Golf Twitter, Golf X, is much different. Because there are a lot of people who are intimately involved in the game, are really, really hardcore about it. And the general reaction is, don't do this. You're ruining the game if you do this. Now, that's generally among younger people or people who are pro equipment or fired up about it in a certain way. And older folks are probably like, who cares? Do you know how bad golf balls were in the 50s, 60s, and 70s? Like, it was terrible. I mean, not the worst, but literally rubber bands, like, went from one ball to the next. You didn't know if one was going to work. Ben Hogan used to put balls in the bathtub, try to figure out which ones worked right. Like, out of a dozen, he'd find like three, and he'd pocket them and hold them for as long as he possibly could, because they might fly straight. So if you're of that generation, obviously there aren't as many of those folks, if you're of that generation that someone says like, oh, equipment rollback, like, oh, but they still are all manufactured really well and they'll fly straight and they won't wobble really weird, cool, I'm in. If you're younger and you learn to play a power game, which I think people, I'm 40, people under my age, you know, kind of 20, let's say 25 and under, they only know golf as a power game. And they will probably be upset, like, why are you taking the distance away from me, bro? And because that's what my son's friends say. And that's probably their reaction. But generally speaking, if you're just a normal person somewhere in the middle and you hit a shot 10 yards less with the driver or 5 yards less with an iron, odds are most golfers aren't even going to notice. Like, if you just handed them a sleeve of balls that are rolled back and you're like, you just hand them a sleeve of Bellottas even. And we're like, hey, play these. They're free. And you go, okay. And you'd hit them less. You'd be like, oh, I guess I'm just not hitting them as good. And then you'd adjust. And it might be a half club difference, might be a whole club difference, might be a quarter club difference, depending on the lie and all kinds of different situation. It's not a lot, but it adds up over the course of a round. So 5% less over the course of a round at 7,000 yards is 350 yards. Well, that's 6,650. So if you're playing a 7,500-yard golf course, that's 375 yards off the top in terms of distance. Okay. That's a little less to maintain for a lot of courses. Now, when's this going to happen? Well, it's going to take a while. So, based on Stachura's reporting, this will be announced in this week. And then the implementation would start for professionals and high-level amateurs. So those who play at like a USGA championship level, high-level amateur golf, collegiate golf, those type of people, in 2028. Everybody else in 2030. It's a long time from now. We're almost in 2024. You're going to get a long run out before you have to change your golf ball. And if someone's smart, they're going to stock up on a whole load of golf balls in 2024 and 2025. Because I promise you, by the time we get to 2029, they're going to be bank run style attempts to get golf balls. People are going to save up on those Pro V1s and Tour X and TP5X and Chrome whatever. I honestly feel like people are going to stock up these balls and then just put them on eBay or whatever the equivalent is that matters in 7 years, 6 years. So I think that'll be kind of funny. But you'll have a lot of time. And that doesn't mean that this is necessarily just going to be met with, well, that's what we're doing. I have no idea what the reaction is going to be. I would get the sense that from Stachura, knowing his beat, I mean, he doesn't really cover the USGA a ton, but he interacts with them. I don't know who told him this, but if it's in multiple industry sources, kind of sounds like it might be more from the equipment side than from the regulation side. So they're just kind of letting the cat out of the bag. Like, this is what's coming, and try to rile people up. But I don't think the reaction's going to be quite that enormous. So, you know, I did a reel about this. Trying to explain this in 60 seconds is not easy. But I did a reel about this, and it's one of the only one I've ever done that's really exploded. I mean, kind of weird, actually. And the reaction has been interesting because a lot of people will have responded on Instagram, I'm bad at golf. I might hit more fairways. This doesn't affect me. I don't care. I don't play in competitions. I also don't care. I'll play whatever golf balls I find. One dude's like, I play range balls when I play normal golf. I'm already hitting less. So I don't think this is going to hit as negatively as maybe a lot of people in the industry might think. I don't think it's going to lead to some kind of massive revolt. And I think, as been pointed out by some folks in the anti-rollback community area, whatever, community seems strong, but anti-rollback people have said, look, professionals can just start to swing faster. They could. Probably will. But some won't. And that'll kind of lead to another iteration of the game. That's the way this works. It's the way it's worked forever. You either evolve or you get cast aside in professional golf. You either find a way to continue to be excellent as equipment changes and improves, or in this case, gets to go backwards. You figure out a way or you're done. And I think a lot of the pro rollback people will be upset because they want more. They want like 10, 20%. And a lot of the anti-rollback people are going to be mad because if it's more than 0%, they don't want that. And a whole lot of people are going to be unhappy. But the USGA and the RNA think this is really important to do. And I don't think this is necessarily the end. I think this is meant to set a precedent. This isn't going to be like, all right, we're doing this one time and one time only, and then we're never doing it again. That's not true. That's not going to be it. Because equipment standards change. They evolve, they change, technology changes, it evolves. There have been multiple rollbacks in golf ball history. Probably the most recent one didn't affect anyone in the United States, and that's when the USGA and the RNA came together on the same size ball, 1.68 inches instead of 1.62. So you went, the small ball went farther. Well, small ball's no longer a thing. It's one ball. Well, that was a rollback. No one stopped playing golf because of that. And I don't think people are going to stop playing golf because of this. If anything, if more people hit fairways and have a little fun and maybe have a little bit more fun, hit more fairways, maybe they'll like it more. I don't know. I don't think it's really going to have a big net effect. So we'll see what happens there. But I, part of me wishes some things were different about it based on what it sounds like. I do wish there were a little bit of a spin standard involved, because low spin off the driver, too low a spin is bad, but there's kind of this perfect range of kind of like 2100, 2200, 2300 spin RPMs for a professional or for a high swing speed. That's kind of optimal. You could have done some things there to make the ball spin more, perhaps. That would have been interesting, but I would have looked at a bigger rollback. Again, I don't think this is meant to be a one-time thing. They're going to make adjustments. As long as no one kind of throws a huge fit here, then, and that could happen. We'll talk about that in a second. But if no one throws a huge fit about this, then they could do this again in 20 years. They go, okay, well, we're going to roll back some more. We're going to go back to, this is kind of our line in the sand. We're not letting it go past this. Or they could have total leadership change and everything changes and they go, you know what? We'll let it go 340. Who cares? I don't know. But this will be the next kind of iteration of equipment standard. Now, here's the big what if. What if the equipment companies and the professional tours just say no? They just say, no, I'm not doing this. We're not adopting this. Now you've got an existential moment for the USGA and the RNA. Because if the equipment companies go, well, we're just going to keep making our golf balls, and then we'll make a golf ball just for the tournaments, you know, just for your events, or just for the ones where that we need them. Well, that's bifurcation. That's what they said they didn't want. At least some of them said they didn't want. Then you kind of get your way. If you're the USGA and the RNA with your original proposal, you get bifurcation. Well, that sends you down a different path. If Titleist were to say, we embrace this because it'll still mean everybody plays the same ball and that gives us our marketing advantage still. We're cool with it. That's probably the end of it. It probably is, because they have such a huge golf ball share. The other equipment companies, they make great products, but they don't have the same kind of ball share. So they're still going to be able to make a great driver. they're still going to be able to make great irons and woods and wedges and putters and those types of things. And that's perhaps to their edge. And maybe they can help engineer equipment that helps a golfer get the max out of the rolled back ball, if Titleist is cool with it. If they all balk and they're like, no, we're just going to keep making, we're going to make two sets of golf balls, they get what they want. They can go and say, all right, well, we're not even going to make two sets of golf balls. We're just going to make one golf ball, the golf ball that we already make. And we're going to dare you to create your own golf ball. Well, then that's chaos, because then the Masters can go, we'll have our own ball. USGA and the RNA can have their own ball. PGA of America might just stick with the old standard, like they've talked about. Now you've got like quadfication at the majors, or trifurcation, I guess. That would be chaos. That would be kind of interesting. You could also have the PGA Tour say, well, we're just not going to adopt this standard. We're going to create our own equipment standard. And as we talked about, for one, that's expensive. And two, I don't think they really want that. That is a can of worms you don't really want to open. At least that would be my point of view about it. So there are a lot of things that could happen as a result of this announcement that are different than just, okay, we're going to do that. Could have court cases. We could have different reactions from different stakeholders. Lots of interesting, weird things can happen here. This isn't the be-all, end-all. This is kind of the beginning of the next chapter, and we'll see what happens. But I think it's fascinating that we're finally going to get this action, and what that looks like, the reaction, the next steps, there's so much to kind of figure out. And I don't mean to like 2030. I mean, in like the next 6 months, what will happen after this will be probably a consistent topic that we'll have pop up here and there with interesting news. We'll go ahead and take a break. We will be back right after this. If you're like me, you've wanted to buy gold for years. Lots of commercials out there, but who can you really trust? I don't want a bad investment, but didn't want to miss the boat either. Sound familiar? Fortunately, I've got great news. If you have an IRA or 401k and want to buy physical gold, eliminate fear and uncertainty from the process using the new Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist. It helps you evaluate and choose the best gold IRA company. I used it personally to vet Augusta Precious Metals, and they are absolutely phenomenal. Use this checklist to choose the best gold IRA company. Text to get your free Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist today. Text GOLF to 68592. Again, text GOLF to 68592. That's GOLF to 68592. Or go to AugustaPreciousMetals.com. All right, welcome back. Appreciate you being here today for this week's show. So I record these shows, podcasts. I record them usually kind of back to back. You know, I just kind of take the morning and I usually do these in the morning, sometime in the afternoons. But just did two off the first, which is my weekday podcast that I do. It's kind of about the two biggest stories in golf that day. A little bit shorter format, although they've been kind of creeping longer. I've got to clean that up a little bit. But they've been, you know, they're 20 minutes usually, 20 to 25 minutes usually. And just kind of get you caught up in a shorter format. Well, then I do this show, you know, on Mondays or Tuesdays, and talk for another, you know, hour or so. And unfortunately, my wife lost her voice a little bit last weekend, and it's come back. But so I'm very cognizant of that, and hopefully that doesn't happen to me. But anyhow, I thought that was kind of funny. So let's get into our second kind of topic for the show, and then we'll have our interview to round out the week. So the drama that's going on, other than around the golf ball, is between the PGA Tour, the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, and John Rahm. This is a story that's kind of taken on a life of its own, but it also kind of ebbs and flows. Really, for the last month and change, there's been chatter out there in different golf circles that John Rahm and Liv had been talking, and that Liv had made a huge offer to John Rahm to join Liv. The first number thrown around that I saw was $300 million. Then I saw a number of $600 million. And I think that $600 million number is more about the potential than the actual money. I think $300 million is probably closer to the actual dollars that he would get. The $300 million on top of that would be, you know, all right, the value of the franchise you would get. you know, we're going to create a 13th team. It's going to be John Rahm's team, and that's going to be for him. And that's going to blow up in value, so it's really worth $600 million. So it doesn't even matter what the number is. It's a nine-figure sum. It's a lot of money that any of us would be hard-pressed not to take. So that number's been out there for a while. And then around Thanksgiving, the notion that Rahm was going to sign kind of blew up a little bit more. Oh, he's done it. It's a done deal. Here we go. They're going to announce it next week. Here it is. And all of that could happen. There is smoke to this, from what I understand. And there's some commonalities here that seem pretty obvious, right? Phil Mickelson is on LIV. Phil's brother, Tim, coached John Rahm at ASU. They have similar representation. That Rahm has been supposedly flirting with LIV a couple of different times over the last couple of years, but he obviously didn't go for this past year. And he's a big Ryder Cup guy, big playing in Spain guy. He likes playing the Spanish Open. So he has connections to those things. And he seems like a guy who wants to play the biggest tournaments. Well, how many are the biggest tournaments? Because as the Masters champion, he's at Augusta for life. As the U.S. Open champion from 2021, he still has 8 years left on that exemption, which will outrun his 5-year exemption for being the Masters champion this year. And he'll be in the Open Championship for another 5 years. He will be in the PGA Championship for another 5 years. And he probably could win one or both of those. I mean, I'm not saying he's going to be a Grand Slam winner, but it's possible. He's a very talented player. So he's in the same position Cam Smith was in, you know, when he won the Open. Of going, okay, well, I'm probably never going to be more valuable than I am right now to the Saudis. I could take this money. I have access to the majors. Hopefully that gamble works off competitively. Doesn't jeopardize my capacity to win majors. I can go make a whole boatload of additional money on LIV and go from there. That's the conundrum, right? And as I said before, someone offers you that sum of money, you're going to listen. You could say no, but you're at least going to listen. And that's where it seems like things are. Now, at the same time, you've got the PGA Tour and the Public Investment Fund, and they are effectively negotiating in public at this point. And they have been for months. PGA Tour either leaked or approved the leak, or someone connected to it got the okay to leak to Bloomberg and the Financial Times, all these different kind of venture capital type publications, that the PGA Tour had received, quote unquote, unsolicited interest in investing alongside the Saudis or in replacement of the Saudis in this new PGA Tour Enterprises idea, this for-profit that would hold all the intellectual property of the PGA Tour and could hypothetically include the intellectual property of the DP World Tour, which the PGA Tour already owns good chunk of DP World Tour or European Tour Productions. That's kind of a proxy to owning a good chunk of the DP World Tour. And then you'd have the LIV and the Saudis. The Saudis would include money and whatever LIV's worth. That would be in there if the Saudis got involved. And that news got out there in the summer almost surely as a way of saying to the Saudis, look, we're having a hard time negotiating. We've got a lot of people banging on our door, and it might be easier to work with them than it might be to work with you. So if you want to work with us, you're going to have to make some concessions. And the Saudis really didn't do anything negotiating in public-wise. They kept it private, and frankly, I think that's their MO, because they had said all along in these negotiations with the PGA Tour, you can't put it out in public, you can't tell people, you have to do this privately, and if you don't, it's not going to work. So that's been their modus operandi. And that's been true with everything LIV. Nobody's negotiating in public with LIV as a player. You don't go, oh, I mean, there are foolish people who do, but the people who really have a chance of playing on LIV don't. And then it comes out and you go, oh, well, that happened. And then that's it. So they're not interested in doing this in public. However, I think that this ROM situation, based on people I've talked to in the industry and just kind of logic, tells you this is their way of negotiating in public. This is their way of telling the PGA Tour what's up. And the reason I think that is because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for the Saudis to sign John Rahm and then do the investment. Let me walk you through that. So let's say the Saudis had signed John Rahm, or are about to, or pick your timing. But if he signed with LIV, for Rahm, it makes a whole load of sense. You get paid, and you assume that something is going to fix this situation. Either they're going to agree to some kind of investment or merger, whatever terminology you like to throw at it. And ultimately, I'm just going to be back playing golf how I want to play golf, in some PGA Tour umbrella where I can play team golf sometimes, or I could play, LIV golf sometimes, and I could play the PGA Tour others, and I could play the DP World Tour others, and I'll have free range of movement. They'll all work it out. You get his gamble if he does that. For the Saudis, they can go, okay, well, we've spent $300 million actual dollars to acquire the services of this guy. We're going to keep doing this until you agree. Well, then the PGA Tour might say, no, you can't poach our guys. We can't do that. We told Congress if you take like five of our guys every year, it's going to be a problem. And Monahan and Herlihy and the board of the players, they go, all right, well, we'll capitulate. We'll give you what you want. Just stop the poaching. Because, by the way, the DOJ made the PGA Tour and LIV take out the anti-poaching clause in their framework agreement. So this is something that the Saudis can expose and use to their advantage. You can just go, oh, DOJ, and we did it, and that's it. So they've got this opportunity to go after really the one and only available player that can move the needle. No offense to Patrick Cantlay or Xander Schauffele, guys who I feel like have been always part of the rumor mill about LIV, but if you offered them $100 million each to come play LIV, they're not enough needle movers to themselves where you go, oh, well, I'll just start watching LIV. That's cool. Tour might be like, hey, thanks for getting some pains in the neck out of the way. So if you're looking at the players who move the needle, and they're like seven in the world, Tiger and Rory, well, they're not going. Rory hates LIV. Tiger hates LIV. They got the TGL thing delayed by a year, but they have business interests that are intertwined. You have Jordan Spieth. He's now on the board, so I don't think he's going anywhere. And I say that as Patrick Cantlay is on the board, but Cantlay's interests are a little different. You got Justin Thomas. That's four. You got John Rahm. That's five. Scottie Scheffler, six. And then you could throw in a LIV player. You could say Brooks. I think people do like to watch Brooks. Say Phil. People still love to watch Phil. But that's kind of it. I mean, maybe Dustin Johnson. But people aren't watching LIV, so for whatever reason. But when they get into contention in majors, they do seem interested. So maybe half. I don't know. Take that for what you will. But let's say seven players. Well, most of them aren't interested in going to LIV, or they're already on LIV, depending on how you count it. So you have like two guys to work with. Scheffler, who I don't think wants that, and Rahm. So this is your one and only guy. So you've got to offer him a ton of money. You've got to use him as a bargaining chip. You have to go and say, all right, well, we're willing to spend $300 million to pay to John Rahm just to turn around and get an agreement with you in the terms that we want. Because they've already spent billions of dollars so far, and if they're going to spend a couple billion more, what's another 10% on top? 15% on top, depending on how much they're going to invest. Cool. Price of doing business. Now, Yasser Al-Rumayyan, who's the head of the Public Investment Fund, the governor of it, and Jay Monahan are supposed to meet this week. How coincidental. This is a couple days after Monahan goes to the New York Times Deal Book Summit and says, hey, I'm going to meet next week with Yasser. We've got options on the table. We expect to have an agreement with the Saudis and a co-investor, suggesting that there's only one other, which is probably Fenway Sports, because they want to get involved in this. But it might be someone else. And that's Jay's way of saying, we've got options. We've still got options. We can kick you out if we want. Then you've got Tiger Woods talking at the Hero World Challenge. By the way, very candidly, I enjoyed what he had to say, because he said, look, we can't have something that works the way that it did before. We need to have governance structure that doesn't allow Jay Monahan, Ed Herlihy, etc., who are non-tour players, to represent us and make an agreement like that ever again. The trust is not there. This will never happen again. It's got to build back. But he also said, look, we've got options. We'd like to get a deal done with the Saudis, but if we don't, here's a state of play. A lot to work out. Very candid about that, I thought. Jordan Spieth, I thought, was pretty candid about it. Then we talked about those kind of three stakeholders. So you've got a kind of game of chicken or chess, or chicken chess, between the PGA Tour, Public Investment Fund. You've got John Rahm kind of squarely in the middle. And what, by the way, what if John Rahm comes to the realization, or comes to the conclusion? Realization's probably not. He probably knows that. But comes to the conclusion, I don't want to be a chess piece. I don't care how much it's worth. I'm not going to do this. Maybe it comes to that conclusion. I think that's a possible one. Not saying a likely one, but a possible one. So you've got these three groups. Then you've got all kinds of different stakeholders on the PGA Tours. Divide that up. You've got the group that is the players who are on the board. Then you've got the kind of, as the No Laying Up guys call them, the mules, the average PGA Tour player, the player that is not a draw, is happy to be on tour, and is kind of upset that now only 70 players make the playoffs instead of 125, that they have to play all the events in the fall to keep their card, all the stuff that's been slung their way, and now they're going to be at a bigger disadvantage because the signature events offer way more points to the players who compete those no-cut events compared to the regular events, and it's harder to get into them, it's hard to access the money, blah, 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 blah. You got them. Now they're starting a petition, some of them, to try to force the tour to hear their demands. But that's a political interest, maybe not expressed properly, but that group of players does have a political interest. Top players have their own political interest. I think you would say the top players have their own interest, because they have ownership of different things. Tiger and Rory, I don't know what the ownership stake, for example, like Justin Thomas or Jordan Spieth might be in TGL, for example. I don't know. They've got to figure all that out. And oh, by the way, the tour wants to give some by the board, because the board wants it, because it's now majority of players. They want to get some equity out in this company to the players, current and future. But what about the past? Well, now you got past players who are in there as a stakeholder group. Well, why don't you get equity if you were the estate of Arnold Palmer or Jack Nicklaus? I mean, why wouldn't he get that? He's a building block. But so that's another stakeholder group. So all of this is kind of at a standstill, and who knows what's going to happen next? And every little move, and there are so many we're never going to hear about or see. But in all these different types of things, just one little move can change everything, and in very unintended ways. And I don't know what intended or unintended consequences could happen between Al Ramayan and Monahan in this meeting, what could happen with Rahm's involvement one way or the other. I don't know. Really don't know. But it feels like we're not at the beginning. We're not. We're farther along. But we're about to enter a new chapter of this. And the PGA Tour saying that we have a firm target of a December 31st agreement, I think is their way of trying to apply additional pressure and saying, look, we can let this thing go December 31st, and we can just take all of the Fenway Sports or whatever money, and we'll just run with that. And that the Saudis can go and say, okay, well, we have unfathomable amounts of money. We're just going to go spend and go poach the best players that we can get. And we'll just keep picking them off, because you've already basically endorsed us as being fine. So we'll go get Rahm, and we'll go get Scheffler, and we'll go spend on all of these things as much as we possibly can until they can't say no. And they're willing to kind of ratchet it up to 11 and beyond. That, on one hand, is, again, It's fascinating. On the other hand, it is frustrating and disappointing and turns so many people off to the game. And I think it's reflected in the interest in the sport at the professional level. Not only in terms of pure numbers, I mean, people tuned in to watch Tiger this weekend, which was great. But I think you see it in the week-to-week numbers on the PGA Tour. And the DP World Tour, for that matter. Which I think people have kind of come to realize is significantly below the PGA Tour now in terms of stature. That doesn't make it bad, just makes it different. Although it really has kind of been this way for a long time. And if people are turning away from the professional game because of all of this, that's bad. Then the next step is whatever happens, whether there's an agreement or not, whether this multifaceted, tour thing happens, whatever it is, then you've got to create a path forward. But you can't create the path forward, I don't think, until you figure out what the headbutting is. Until it either stops, or there's hand-holding, or whatever it is. I don't know. But something has to end or come to a truce before golf can move forward. And there's going to be a lot of tumult ahead. And I don't think it's any closer to being resolved than it was when June 6th happened. And here we are 6 months later. It's not different. So I think this is the long-term problem. All right, we'll go ahead and take a break. We'll come back right after this. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. One final segment this week. It's our interview. Keneal Martinez is a U.S. Army veteran, was a sergeant. And he is also an ambassador for PGA Hope. And the HOPE in PGA Hope stands for Helping Our Patriots Everywhere. And it's the flagship military program of the charitable foundation of the PGA of America, which is called PGA Reach. And PGA Hope introduces veterans and active duty military to golf to help them with their physical, mental, social, and emotional well-being. And it's accomplished through developmental programs that are typically like 6 to 8 weeks in curriculum, and they're led by PGA professionals, and those professionals are trained in military cultural competency and teaching adaptive golf for those who have to play adaptive golf. And the programs are funded by PGA Reach. They're supplemented through the PGA. All the programming is free. And Keneal joined me last week to talk about the program, him being an ambassador for the program, and not so much about how the program works, but about what it means to veterans who are part of this program, not only from the standpoint of taking up the game of golf, but the community and the camaraderie of the veteran community and what that means to the people participating. So please enjoy this conversation with Sergeant Keneal Martinez. Keneal Martinez is with us. He is one of the PGA Hope ambassadors. And if you're not familiar with PGA Hope, it's an incredible program that has kind of developed in really what the last 15 years or so. And it's really designed in helping introduce and welcome folks from military service and first responder backgrounds into our game and making them feel extremely welcome and hopefully making a great place for them to kind of prosper and thrive. So, Keneal, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it. Can you give people a sense of your background within the military and then how you got into the game of golf?
Certainly, Ryan, and thank you for having me today. So I served in the U.S. Army. I was a mechanic and a truck driver for about 8 years, but I also served in the reserves, so 12 years altogether. The way I was actually introduced to golf, while I was at Walter Reed recovering from my injuries, I started just getting involved with nonprofit organizations. And I first started with fly fishing, if believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And from fly fishing, eventually somebody said, hey, there's golf. And, and of course, I was a bit apprehensive because we all know how expensive golf can get. But I decided to at least, try and learn the game. And eventually I started, being pretty decent because I've played sports all my life, growing up. And eventually I found PGA Hope through one of those programs. And I applied and I got accepted. So, I was able to go ahead and take advantage of the golf lessons.
For folks who may not be familiar with PGA Hope, can you give a sense of
what the program tries to accomplish in terms of working with those military backgrounds, and what are the benefits that are potentially on offer to someone who wants to take full advantage of the program?
So one of the main benefits I found about PGA Hope is that it brings veterans together, right? Because many of us, when we, you know, take off that uniform, we find ourselves, you know, wondering what our next step in life will be. So just being able to, you know, be around people that understand what you're going through and, you know, maybe have a word of wisdom is definitely a positive, right? So being able to learn something that you probably never thought that you could learn is definitely the second positive, because many people don't understand, you know, that golf can be anything you want it to be, right? You could be out there just challenging your friends, right? Like, hey, man, you know, if I make this hole, hey, you know, I get a beer, right? Or it could be like, hey, man, you know, one day I want to be able to use golf as a vehicle, you know, to reach more people that could be in your very same situation. And then you can even surprise yourself by, you know, going as far as you can and using golf, you know, to reach even more people.
When did you first get involved in PGA Hope, and how did you kind of evolve into this ambassador role with which you now have?
So I actually got involved with PGA Hope about 2 years ago. I did one of their clinics over at a congressional country club. And, you know, but I've always been eager to better my game, right? Just because, like I said, I've never thought that I could play it. And I actually find myself enjoying it and actually challenging some of my friends on the golf course. But I'm not going to challenge you unless I know my game, you know, is up to par, right? So from there, I try to get into, you know, another program another golf lesson through congressional, but I was not accepted. And eventually I ended up getting accepted at University of Maryland. And, you know, when I was there, I actually started just helping other veterans, right? And, you know, kind of giving them tips, because everybody comes at different levels, right? And of course, having been playing the game of golf for a little over 10 years now, the coach just, you know, took a liking, and he will ask me to come back and, you know, share my thoughts with some of the other veterans. And eventually he just asked me, hey, man, I'm going to put you in, you know, for an ambassador. I said, okay. And that's how I was selected to be an ambassador for the Middle Atlantic region.
How much pride do you take in that? And what do you feel kind of your, maybe responsibility is too strong a word, but sense of responsibility about representing the veteran community as part of PGA Hope?
You know, I don't think responsibility is too strong of a word, because I can relay, you know, my duties as an ambassador right back to being an NCO in the Army, right? Having other soldiers' lives and, you know, livelihoods in your hands, essentially. So when it comes to golf, I look at it that way. Hey, what is this person going through, and, you know, and trying to find out why did they reach out, you know, to the game of golf, you know, to continue their journey. So sometimes you may be surprised that, you know, they're going through something that you have been through. And by you taking the time and letting them know, hey, man, you know, like, I got you, I'm here, it takes such a, you know, a weight off of their shoulders, and it allows them to just, you know, have fun and enjoy the game.
I've never served this country. I've never served the military, but I would imagine it takes a lot of courage to be able to go up to someone who is, after having served, a fellow peer, and just have an honest conversation about what you went through in your military experience, good, bad, indifferent. Is that one of the most important parts of just getting someone involved with a program like this, is just meeting them where they are?
Most definitely. A lot of times, like I mentioned before, people think that they're the only ones going through, you know, whether it's a breakup or, you know, maybe facing foreclosure on their property, or, you know, they don't have transportation to get from point A to point B. And, you know, a lot of us have been there, right? And we know what that feeling is. So wanting to, you know, to not be able to experience that again easily translate to not wanting any, you know, the next person to experience the same thing. And from there, it's like, hey, how can I help you, you know, get us, put a smile on your face?
How can you put this into perspective for someone who hasn't served? How strong is that band, that community between veterans, whether you serve directly alongside somebody or you are a generation apart?
You know, it is, it's a very strong bond because, you know, people hear a veteran making, you know, maybe an Army soldier making fun of a Marine, or, you know, a Navy guy making fun of an Army guy. But at the end of the day, when it comes down to helping each other, you know, like, we're there. You know, if we give our word that, hey, man, you know, I can help you with this, but if I can't, I will find somebody that, you know, that can help you. That's, it literally goes that far.
Well, that sounds as big a part of it of being involved in PJ Hope as the golf piece of it. Is that fair to say? And how do, what kind of skill level do people come into PGA Hope with, and does it range pretty wildly from no experience whatsoever to pretty good, or they kind of come in a general range of skill levels?
No, it comes pretty wide. I mean, I've seen people that, like I said, grew up maybe, you know, in a small town and, you know, never even played sports for their high school team, to somebody that's, you know, played when they were little, and because of their military service, you know, lost a limb, whether it'll be an arm or a leg, and now they're just trying to get back into it. But because of their shortcomings, you know, they don't know how to transition, right? Because all they remember is, man, I used to have, you know, both hands, both legs, and my hips, you know, rotated properly. But now that, you know, some of that is missing, they need to relearn. So that is also where PGA Hope, you know, excels. Right, is allowing the person to understand, hey, there's still other ways that you can achieve the same goals, you know, where you're at right now.
How important is having that piece of achievement you can go after, whether that's after being injured mentally or physically, whether that's a severe injury, whether that's a relatively minor injury? How important is that for a veteran?
Oh, it is very important because, you know, it shows that regardless of what you've been through, you can still continue to be a productive member of society, right? I mean, you see people that, as a matter of fact, you know, I was sharing with somebody that when you participate in nonprofits, sometimes that is viewed just as important as being in a paid position, right? Because at the end of the day, you're still putting, you know, your knowledge and your experience into practice when you're sharing, you know, a story with somebody, or you're trying to help them, you know, get to the next step.
For folks who might be listening to this, whether they know someone that's a veteran or they themselves are a veteran, and they might just be interested in trying to get involved in the game and PGA Hope, what's that first step? How do they do that?
So they can go to the website, PGA Hope, and, you know, they can look at the different regions that are available. And they can sign up, and then somebody will reach out to them. And then if there's a spot available, they will get it.
And what do you hope to accomplish with PJ Hope in the next couple of years, whether that's as an ambassador or with your own game?
As an ambassador, I certainly, you know, would like to be able to spread the word about the program. I mean, I see every single day, you know, all the benefits of just getting out of your house, right, and engaging with other veterans. Personally, you know, I just want to be able to get out there and enjoy something that otherwise I wouldn't have been able to enjoy had I not, you know, found the organizations that have helped me thus far.
Well, Sergeant Martinez, thank you for your service, first of all. I very much appreciate that. And thank you for spending some time with me to talk about PGA Hope. I very much appreciate that as well. Thanks for spending some time with me.
Hey, thank you for having me, Ryan.
Thanks to Keneal for being on the show. He was great to talk with. He's a local guy to me. He's in the D.C. area as well, Baltimore, D.C. corridor. Really enjoyed talking with him. Hopefully we can actually tee it up soon at Argyle Country Club. Our club does a lot of work with military organizations and military golf organizations. The one that we work with is Sloop Military Golf Association. We actually have their headquarters, their office space in our clubhouse, and they do phenomenal work. And the people I've met through SMGA and now PGA Hope, they're incredible individuals and just really great people to get to know, and cannot be more grateful for what they do and what they have done on our behalf as Americans. All right, that's going to do it for us this week on the show. Thanks so much for spending some time with me. I appreciate it. If you would, leave a 5-star review, leave a comment, helps us reach more people. I'm available on email, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. I'm available on pretty much every social network, Twitter or X, Threads, Instagram, Blue Sky at Ryan Ballingy. You can find Golf News Net at the same handle on all of those services, except Blue Sky. Golf News Net's not on Blue Sky. And we'll be back with what will probably be the final show for the year next week. Thanks so much for your support. Really appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon on the 19th Hole Golf Show.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.